Is there any legitimacy to the claim that Israel's violence against Palestinians and its violations of international law are rooted in self-defense? How can Israel's victimhood narrative be disrupted? Is the two-state solution a viable solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict any longer? What impacts, if any, is the boycott, divestment, sanction campaign against Israel having on that country's policy? What is at the heart of the Canadian government's recent cooperation agreements with Israel on jointly fighting BDS, and what impact can they have? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, on the occasion of his Canadian tour, we speak at length to the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Jeff Halper, about the prospects for peace in the Middle East. Plus, we get a perspective from Canadian author and activist Eve Engler on the Harper government's recent overtures toward Israel. On today's program, Israel-Palestine and the Path to Peace, conversations with Jeff Halper and Eve Engler. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 6, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Saying he believes a medical condition gives him only a few years to live, and that he is filled with remorse, Dr. Udo Ulfkote, the editor of Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, one of Germany's largest newspapers, said in an interview that he accepted news stories written and given to him by the CIA and published them under his own name. Ulfkote said the aim of much of the deception was to drive nations toward war. Dr. Ulfkote says the corruption of journalists and major news outlets by the CIA is routine, accepted, and widespread in the Western media, and that journalists who do not comply either cannot get jobs at any news organization or find their careers cut short. Dr. Ulfkote is the author of a book currently available only in German, Bought Journalists. Aged 55, he was also once an advisor to the government of German Chancellor Helmut Kohl. The book has become a bestseller in Germany, but in a bizarre twist, which Ulfkote says characterizes the disconnect caused by CIA control of the Western media, the book cannot be reported on. That's from the article. Editor of major German newspaper says he planted stories for the CIA, by Ralph Lopez, posted February 4th, originally appearing at reader-supported news. A report submitted to the United Nations Security Council by UN observers in the Golan Heights over the past 18 months shows that Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, have been in regular contact with Syrian rebels, including Islamic State, ISIS, militants. Citing the UN report, Haaretz noted that there have been several instances detailed in the report that shows close ties between Syrian armed rebels and Israeli army. A statement issued by a group of Druze activists accused the Israeli government of supporting radical Sunni factions such as the Islamic State, or ISIS. Replying to a question by I24 News on whether Israel has given medical assistance to members of al-Nusra and Daesh, that's the Arabic acronym for the Islamic State, Israeli military spokesman's office said, quote, "In the past 2 years, the Israel Defense Forces have been engaged in humanitarian life-saving aid to wounded Syrians, irrespective of their identity," unquote. That's from the article, Israel Supports Syrian Al-Qaeda Rebels, Including the Islamic State, UN Report, by John Lee Varghese, posted February 4th, originally appearing in the International Business Times. A consensus-building process to wage war is similar to the Spanish Inquisition. It requires social subordination. The political consensus cannot be questioned. In its contemporary version, the Inquisition requires and demands submission to the notion that war is a means to spreading Western values and democracy. The big lie has now become the truth, and the truth has become a conspiracy theory. Factual analysis of social, political, and economic issues is a conspiracy theory because it challenges a consensus which is based on a lie. That's from the article, What is a Conspiracy Theory? What is the Truth? By Professor Michelle Chostodowski, posted February 5th. A crowd of several hundred people has begun storming the Ukrainian Presidential Administration's office, a TASS correspondent reports from the scene. Protest demonstrators have penetrated the first cordon of the National Guards and are trying to make their way to the conference hall. National Guards in full riot gear entered a brawl with the demonstrators, who are demanding access to TV cameras for a statement. Earlier, demonstrators demanded the introduction of martial law and resignation of all top law enforcement officials, including the defense minister and prosecutor general. Also, one of their demands is the removal of the 25th Kievan Rus Battalion of the Ukrainian Armed Forces from the area of Debaltseve. That's from the article, Crowd of Several Hundred Tries to Storm Ukrainian Presidential Administration Office, by Itar Tass, posted February 5th, originally appearing at Tass, Russian news agency. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Well, I'm joined right now by Jeff Halper. He is the coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and a leading figure in the Israeli peace movement. He was nominated for the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize and has published numerous books and articles while working tirelessly for peace. And these articles can be found at the website www.icahd.org. He's currently on a cross-Canada tour in which he's speaking about the current situation in Israel-Palestine. So Jeff Halper, I've caught him in the middle of his tour. He's currently in Ottawa. How are you doing, Dr. Halper?
All right, I'm holding up.
Excellent. Okay, do you want to just, first of all, maybe start off with a little bit of a backgrounder? Why did you choose to structure your activism around preventing house demolitions?
Well, we in fact are an Israeli peace organization that fights the entire occupation. We're trying to even be involved in conceiving what a just peace would look like overall between Israelis and Palestinians. But occupation is very abstract for most people. And so the house demolition issue kind of makes it much more visual and concrete. You know, here's a family, here come the Israeli army and the bulldozers, and the home is demolished, and what happens to the family? So the house demolition issue kind of encapsulates the conflict itself, because there's a connection between home and homeland. So if you say to people, as Israel has since 1948, Israel's demolished something like 120,000 Palestinian homes, about 48,000 since the occupation began in 1967, 18,000 just this summer in Gaza, during the attacks on Gaza. So if you deny people a home, individually or collectively, the message is get out. And so we found that the house demolition issue isn't only a kind of a sub-issue of the occupation, but in fact, it's the essence of the conflict. And by helping Palestinians remain in their homes, by rebuilding homes, we've rebuilt 187 homes as political acts of resistance, and by using house demolitions as a way of exposing how the occupation works and what Israel's intentions are, we found it really a very effective tool in making the occupation both more clear to people, also to make Israel accountable for what it's doing, because Israel's a strong party. And not only that, but, you know, Israel has framed the whole conflict in a way that it's the victim and the Palestinians are the terrorists. And what you see in the house demolition issue is it's the opposite. And that is that only 0.5% of the homes demolished had anything to do with terrorism. They're all homes of innocent people that Israel is simply demolishing, either in military invasions or because it won't allow them to rebuild homes. And so it's a proactive policy of a strong Israeli government over people who are not terrorists, people who are simply normal people who want homes in their land, and Israel won't allow it.
And it seems to be a consensus. It doesn't matter who gets elected to power. The house demolitions and the occupation continues. I mean, is there any significant deviation between the different parties that have occupied power?
No. It's a constant. Whether it's Labor or Likud or any other party, it's just a constant. And it also doesn't matter if you're in negotiations. It doesn't matter how sensitive the moment might be and you're trying to build trust between the sides. Nothing matters. It's an absolute constant. In the last 3 days, Israel's demolished close to 50 Palestinian homes. You know, more than 100 people have been left, much more than 100 people have been left homeless. It's relentless. It goes on and on and on. And it doesn't only happen in the occupied territory. In fact, Israel demolishes more homes of its own citizens who are Arabs, either Palestinians or Bedouins, than it does in the occupied territory. So to the degree that it's a part of an ethnic cleansing process of what Israel itself calls Judaizing the country and taking Palestinian land and either driving them out of the country or driving them into little enclaves in the country, it's a constant with all Israeli governments. There's never been a government that declared a halt to house demolitions.
And the house demolitions are exclusively of Palestinian homes.
Exclusively. I mean, Arab, Palestinian or Bedouins. I mean, now there's less and less of a difference between the two, but never, ever of Jewish homes. I mean, occasionally you'll have, a settler will set up a shack on a hilltop on top of on Palestinian land. Occasionally, the army might come and knock it down, but that really isn't a house demolition. You're not denying anyone a home. It's illegal, the rebuilding, and it's not really their home anyway. It's just another outpost. But so you could really say that the entire policy of demolitions takes place against the Palestinian population.
Now, what, as far as the settlements is concerned, what is the motivation of the vast majority of the settlers who move there? Is it part of some ideological desire to maintain a toehold of the Jewish population, or is it?
Right. There's a confluence of interests, because on the one hand, it's true the settlers go move there, and often, like I said, they build outposts, they take proactive actions to take Palestinian land and displace people. Hebron, for example, is hell for Palestinians, and the settlers are, of course, protected by the army, so they can do these sorts of violent things without fear of retribution or or any fear at all because they have the army behind them. That's part of the story. But the other part is, of course, the settlers couldn't act at all. Settlers couldn't be there unless the Israeli army supported that enterprise. I mean, we talk about settlements. It's not really the right word because it minimizes the reality. It sounds like a couple little shacks on a hilltop. But in fact, many of the settlements are large cities. Maale Adumim is close to 50,000 people. Pisgat Ze'ev Neve Yaakov is more than 100,000 people. You have, you know, these are big satellite cities of Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, you know, with massive highways leading in and out. So the infrastructure, building a city, the roads and the sewage systems, electrical systems, the phone systems, you know, the commercial areas, the municipal, everything that goes into a city isn't done by the settlers. This is done by the Israeli army or the Israeli government. And so the Israeli government it partly uses the settlers, the ideological ones, to be like the pioneers in a sense, and go into Palestinian areas that no one wants to go into, but you know they go in because they want to displace the Palestinians, and then they're followed by the government that then brings in larger populations once the settlers have kind of secured the area in some ways. So it's a very organized process. I mean, just today, and then I was reading in the Israeli paper, another couple thousand homes have been approved in the West Bank. So it goes on and on and on.
Hmm. Could you touch on this, which you mentioned earlier, this narrative of Israel as victim? Because it seems to be quite persistent. It certainly was used extensively during the siege on Gaza just this last summer. In fact, the Israeli officials, they said they were acting in self-defense by targeting Hamas's military arsenal and rocket-launching sites, and they claimed that Hamas was using Gaza civilians as human shields. I think it's very important to kind of, you know, deconstruct that.
That's right. Well, we call it reframing the conflict. What Israel does is it presents a picture where there's no occupation. I mean, you could actually put the whole Israeli case, the way it presents it, in one sentence, which is a pretty powerful thing to do if you're on the radio and you only have a couple sentences. The Israeli case is Israel is a small white, European, so there's a certain racial undertone here. It's a small European democratic country besieged by Arab Muslim terrorism. That's it. In that one sentence, you hit every single buzzword. And of course, the word that's missing from that sentence is occupation. So it's all depoliticized. You know, it's as if in Gaza, they're just shooting rockets. It's as if there's no occupation of 47 years. It's as if these people aren't refugees of 1948. It's as if there's no a siege on Gaza for the last 20 years. All that is gone, and Israel becomes the victim, which of course dovetails with the whole kind of image of Jews as victims. So it builds on that as well. And, of course, Israel brings a Holocaust in every chance it gets. So that you have a weird situation where the reality is turned on its head. You have a strong country like Israel with a strong economy. Israel is the third or fourth largest arms exporter in the world. It's the fourth largest nuclear power. Israel has something like 300 nuclear warheads. It has six nuclear submarines. It's the occupying power. The Palestinians are not occupying Israel. So you put all that power together, plus occupation, and yet you come out as the victim. You see? And your victims, they become the perpetrators. So the whole power relationship is inverse. The people of Gaza that have lived under occupation for a half a century, that don't have any food, that can't fish, that are under siege, they become the aggressors. And Israel, which is the occupying power, becomes a victim. And being a victim is a very powerful place to be, because if you're the victim, you can't be held accountable for what you're doing. You're not responsible because you're the victim. So if Israel can combine power and control over Palestinians with no accountability, because it's the victim, it's home free. And so that's part of what the house demolition issue reframes, because we show that these are not terrorists, these families, they're innocent people, and Israel's policies are in fact proactive. They're not defensive. They're proactive in the sense that Israel wants to Judaize the entire country and displace the Palestinians. So our reframing tries to counter that idea that Israel's the victim and the Palestinians are the aggressors, and invert the picture the way it should be.
But, I can understand where people who live in Israel, and like I hear about how they have to put their children on separate buses because you never know when when these attacks are going to come. I mean, they do feel, and whether or not they might have originally been supportive of a particular government, they still think. I can understand why they might feel that sense of victimhood.
Sure.
Are you saying that you're, with the campaign against house demolitions, it's making a breakthrough and I guess interrupting that narrative?
I hope so. That's what we've been trying. That's why I'm in Ottawa and coming to Winnipeg. I hope I can break that, because if we can't,
it is a dominant narrative.
The conflict's going to go on.
Mm-hmm.
Look, just in terms of what you're saying, the oppressors are always scared. I mean, they're strong. They're the oppressors. If you look in colonial Africa, you look anywhere where you have oppression, the oppressors are always scared, because they know that the oppressed people can never accept the oppression. They have to resist. Oppressed people aren't going to say, the Gazans aren't going to say, fine, occupy us, deny us our rights, deny us our food, and you'll be safe to take buses. No, they resist it. You're building as an oppressor, as an occupying power, an unstable, unjust, violent situation. But it's not the people of Gaza that have built this situation. It's Israel. That's the strong party. And so, if Israel wants to resolve, the Palestinians can't resolve this. They have no power. The United States supports Israel. I mean, where are the Palestinians? Canada. Not, it's probably the most pro-Israel country in the world. Where are the Palestinians going to go? And so they resist. And that resistance, that's part of the framing of Israel, is called terrorism. And so you end up blaming the oppressed for resisting oppression, and the occupiers, the oppressors, the strong party that have caused this and keep it going, they come out as the victims. Because their kids can't take buses and not be afraid of rockets. So you see, the whole thing is turned on its head. And what we're saying is Israel is the only party that can end this conflict. The Palestinians have accepted the two-state solution. They've accepted the right of Israel to exist. They've reached out in peace. And Israel wants the entire country and has refused. So if these Israeli kids, if their parents are afraid to put them on buses, it's because their government has kept this occupation and this conflict going. It's not the Palestinians' fault.
Hmm. But there is that sense, though, of, the individual Israelis, I mean, they're just wanting to live their lives. They have no particular malice against the Palestinians.
Well, that's not true. I mean, that's not true. They know what's going on. We have newspapers in Israel. They know there's an occupation. They know what we're doing. It's not a secret. So the point is that they're not taking responsibility. They're the citizens of a country that has a military occupation over a people that only wants its freedom. That's all the Palestinians want, and they keep electing governments and supporting wars to suppress and destroy that people. So they're not. They might be individual citizens, but they can't claim. Now you're getting into kind of other places where the Jews were oppressed and the people oppressing them said, we didn't know. You know, we just were living our lives in Germany. We didn't know what was happening. And so, you know, it's a very slippery slope. You have to hold citizens, especially in a democracy like Israel, where there's a freedom of information, you can know what's happening, you have to hold citizens responsible, accountable for what they're doing.
Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I know, like, he probably on this side of the Atlantic, I mean, I'm wondering if inability to address the injustice that's mm-hmm. taking place. I've heard that all evil is a failure of at least one of two deficits: a deficit of of empathy, or mm-hmm. a deficit of information. So,
or an interest. Israel has an interest in keeping the occupation. It isn't just a mistake or a delusion or. It has an interest. You know, the occupied territory, first of all, is territory Israel wants. The settlers are good. You know, it has 200 settlements, so it's intentional. And the occupied territory, we have to be honest, is an important part of the Israeli economy. It's where Israel tests and develops weapons and security systems. You know, Israel didn't sign what's called the Canada-Israel Public Safety Agreement, where it's involved in training your police and your border controls and your prisons and so on, just because it's Israel. It has that expertise and it has those technologies of control because of the occupation. So it's not only a lack of imagination, it's a proactive policy because you have political claims and economic claims to somebody else's territory mm-hmm. and the power to enforce it.
Okay, could you talk a bit about the two-state solution? I understand that you don't support that right. option.
Well, no, that's not true. The Israeli peace movement always supported the two-state option.
You just don't think it's viable.
That's right. In other words, we've supported it, and really, it's a Palestinians' call. So, if the Palestinians support it as they have, I'm not going to tell them no. I mean, it's their call. But it's true, I've come to the conclusion, and I talk about this, that it's way past gone. The two-state solution is gone. It's dead. We should even stop talking about it. And it's buried under the weight of Israeli settlements. You know, there's no way in the world that the United States or Canada are going to force Israel out of the cities of 50, 60, 70,000 people in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. It's just not going to happen. And so we have to bite the bullet and say, we have two choices. Either we allow the present situation to stay, which means that we accept an apartheid state, because you do have one state today. Israel is over the whole country, from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, and it's confining the Palestinians to little islands with no human rights or civil rights. That's apartheid. So our choice is we either allow that to continue, or we go with the flow, say to Israel, look, you created one state. You, Israel, rejected the two-state solution by your settlements, but that one state now has to be transformed into a democratic state for all its citizens with equal rights. And the whole idea of a democratic state of equal rights shouldn't be such a foreign idea to Canadians. I mean, you know, democracy is what you guys are trying to promote in the world. Here's a people, the Palestinians are saying, please, we want democracy, we want freedom. And Canada is selling them instead apartheid.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Do you have any insights into impact the boycott, divest, sanction is having? Is it taking hold? Is it leading to in a positive direction?
I think so. The Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, the BDS movement, is very important. We've always supported it because it's the way, you know, states are not carrying out their responsibilities. States say we're responsible for foreign affairs. We make wars. We have an exclusive right. But look at the world, the way it is. And look at Israel-Palestine in particular, where states like Canada and the United States have allowed this to go on and still support Israel in its occupation after all these years. So at some point, civil society, people, churches, trade unions, students, university groups, political organizations, the average citizen has to stand up and say, no, we're committed to democracy, we're committed to peace, a just peace, and we're going to do something to push our governments if they're not going to do this themselves. And in a way that I think I've discovered an iron law, and that is that governments will not do the right thing, period, unless they're pushed by the people. So BDS is that pushing, and I think it is having an effect. Less of a financial, economic effect. I mean, Israel's a tremendously powerful country, and its military industries do very well, thank you, without BDS. But morally, I think it calls attention to the immorality of the occupation and how it's structured and how it's financed. And it gives people, even if you're not buying lettuce from Israel, it gives people an opportunity to say, I'm not going to participate in this. I don't want my country to be complicit. And I think from that point of view, it really is having a great effect in terms of changing public opinion about the conflict. And I think that's what Israel is very concerned about.
Hmm. Dr. Halpert, could I get you to compare the current situation in Israel with South Africa? I mean, some of the... Are there extra challenges with Israel, the situation in Israel that didn't exist with South Africa? Are they different in any conceivable way? Because they both constitute apartheid regimes, right?
That's right. No, and we make a comparison. I mean, there's certainly not a one-to-one correspondence, but look, essentially, in international law, apartheid is defined by two elements. One is separation. That's the apart. Apartheid. So it's when one population separates itself from the others. And then that population creates a permanent institutionalized regime of domination. In other words, it's not discrimination. It's a regime where the way it's structured, the rules, the laws, are to keep one population dominant over another. And that's completely what you have in Israel over Palestine. So it doesn't matter if apartheid is based on race, like in South Africa, or ethnicity, nationalism, religion, like in Israel-Palestine, or on the color of your eyes. As long as you have a regime of separation and domination, that you can call that apartheid. So we make some very clear comparisons between the two regimes.
Hmm. Now, I know that we have, we were living right now, I mean, we had the 9/11 attacks, got the right up to the whole business with ISIS in the Middle East, and the Charlie Hebdo attacks, Boko Haram.
Right.
There seems to be an extent to which Islam is being mixed up, not correctly, in my view, but with the violence and bloodshed,
right.
And I'm wondering if that isn't frustrating efforts to bring about peace in Israel, as the Palestinian population, much of them are connected with Islamism and Islamic terrorism. Could you speak to that point?
I mean, there's different levels of that. First of all, the Palestinians are not really connected with that. I mean, Hamas, which is actually electorally is not a large party. Probably 15 or 20% of the Palestinians actually identify with the Hamas ideology. But Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood. It's not Al-Qaeda, and it's not Hezbollah, and it's not Shiite, of course. So, you know, Israel's attempt to conflate everything. Netanyahu gets up and says, Hamas is Hezbollah, Hezbollah is Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda is ISIS, ISIS is the Chechens, and it goes on and on and on. He's simply stupid, and he knows it's not true. He knows it's demagogic because there's some very real differences between those groups. But Hamas is not a part of that whole terrorist. And as a matter of fact, the European Court of Justice just ruled that Hamas, in fact, is not a terrorist organization. So it's being taken off the terrorist list in Europe. You know, it's a resistance organization, that's true. And it uses violence sometimes in ways that it shouldn't. It shouldn't throw rockets on civilians. That's true as well. But nevertheless, the attempt of the global north, including Israel, to characterize all resistance to neocolonialism, to exploitation, to capitalism, to occupation, to apartheid, as terrorism, is simply self-serving. And in fact, the states, you know, the United States, Europe, kill far more innocent people than do the so-called terrorist groups. I mean, the United States and its coalition of the willing has killed more than 1 million innocent people in Iraq. I mean, Al-Qaeda could never dream of doing something like that. So if you actually define terrorism by killing innocent people, these self-righteous states that are calling others terrorists are in fact the perpetrators. And not only that, but a lot of the terrorism, a lot of the violence that exists, as irrational and terrible as it is still a reaction to neocolonialism. The European countries, you know, set up fake governments, fake states, fake borders, dividing people not only in the Middle East, in Africa, in Latin America, and other parts of the world that until today are generating conflict. So in many ways, and of course, the global north is also involved in arming one side against the other. So you're in a situation where you still have neocolonialism. You still have the global north trying militarily and economically to control peoples. And I think, you know, it's not taking the right form in a way, but I think a lot of this violence are peoples trying to take their lives back, take their cultures back, reorganize their parts of the world the way they want. And they're being, so I really, you know, I don't like the word terrorist. It's not a human rights term. It's a loaded term, but it certainly covers the fact that the global north, our so-called democratic white countries, are much more exploitative and violent towards innocent people than these terrorist groups are.
Now, the fact that there's been so much, I mean, we've seen with the sieges in Gaza, and of course all the house demolitions throughout Israel and the occupied territories. There seems to be it's not just that they're waging violence, but it seems as if they're fostering a mentality of cruelty and even racism.
Right.
Could you speak to that point? I mean, why is it that they would be so intense in their attitudes to marginalize people this way, to reduce
right.
them to the, even second class citizens seems a little bit
right.
considerate. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, you know, when you're a small, I don't think they represent very much.
Okay, one sec.
So when you have small groups, you know, there's a vacuum here. You don't have normal governments in these countries, you know, partly because, again, the global north led by the United States determined, you know, they do regime change. They decide who's going to be the government, who's going to be the head of state, who's going to get armies. They have no compunction about arming resistance groups to legitimate governments. You know, the whole thing is completely completely turned around in the third world. So some of these groups are small groups, and they use violence to intimidate, like all terrorist groups do. And part of that is probably from their weakness, the fact that most people don't support them. But at the same time, they don't. You have what are called failed states, states that aren't able to protect their citizens and move ahead. But that's mainly because they're not allowed to take control of their countries. The global north keeps control. That's why we call it neocolonialism. So that you have to look at the bigger picture, and these little actors are, in a sense, reacting, or they're filling a vacuum. But you're talking about a completely non-normal situation that's been created, actually, by the powerful countries, the neocolonial countries.
Now, what about the in the region, the so-called moderate Arab countries? What investment in if any do they have in the existence of Israel? Because they're often portrayed as wanting to, you know, as part of that hostile force that's seeking to eliminate the state of Israel. What do they have in some sense an investment in maintaining Israel in the name of domestic or other reasons?
Well, I mean, if you look at it, we talk about the Israel-Arab conflict. But in fact, if you look at it, if you take out the Palestinian issue, there's no greater common foreign policy goals than those between Israel and these conservative Arab states. I think Israel is closer to Sisi in Egypt than it is to Canada. It's close to Saudi Arabia. It's close to the Gulf states. It's close to the conservative regimes, because they're all worried about the same thing, and that's the people. The people and economic development these are like little puppet regimes of the global north, many of them. I mean, Israel not only gets $4 billion a year in arms, Egypt gets about $2.5 billion in arms from the United States. So, you know, it's again this manipulation that's happening that deprives the peoples of the region their right to self-determination, to rule their own lives. And so these are all, you know, Saudi Arabia just bought this year $74 billion of arms from the United States. So these aren't real countries. These are gangster cliques that are all kept in power by the global north because they're self-serving. And Israel's a part of that. You know, they get along very well with Israel. Israel hasn't had a war with an Arab country for 40 years. And then the Palestinians get in the middle because the Palestinians want democracy. They want freedom. Other Arab peoples are looking to them as a model. And Israel and the Arab governments are very afraid of the Palestinians. So these regimes really don't have much legitimacy.
Maybe if you could just give us a breakdown of some of the main points that you've been emphasizing through your tour. I know that you're talking about the current crisis. What are the main things you want Canadians to talk about, to think about?
Well, I guess the big picture is that this is a conflict that's not only affecting the wider Middle East, and has to be urgently resolved. I mean, John Kerry said not long ago that you're not going to get to the bigger problems of the Middle East, ISIS, Iran, Syria, the whole meltdown in the Middle East, until you resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict. It doesn't cause them all, but it prevents us from going on and stabilizing the wider Middle East. So there's an urgency. But beyond that, of course, this conflict disrupts the entire international community. I mean, Canada is scared of, you can't get on an airplane with a toothpaste tube. So obviously this Canada is securitizing, it's inviting Israel into your police systems, your cities are being securitized. There's this whole paranoia about security here and militarism and so on. Which feeds into neoliberalism, of course. And the whole conflict just feeds into an oppressive system that finally gets to Winnipeg. It's not confined to Gaza. There's a real connection. And the Gazans are not the end users of Israeli weapons. The people of Winnipeg are the end users through your police forces. And so my message is, not only is this an important issue to resolve, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, but in a global sense, resolving this and these other conflicts will go a long way towards securing all our lives in a just way. We have to redo the whole international system in a way in which people really have a stake. People really have freedom. People really have economic ability. And the world that the global north, including Canada, has constructed is the world of violence and warfare and division and unfreedom. And that's what we have to call attention to, I think. So I see the Israel-Palestine conflict is kind of a microcosm, kind of a mirror of a much larger reality in which Canada is not playing a positive role.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff Halper, I want to really thank you for, you've been very generous with your time. I know you've got some, a lot of things going on today. Thanks, and good luck for the rest of your tour, and I look forward to seeing you when you swing through Winnipeg.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me on.
We've been listening to noted peace activist Jeff Halper, past nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize and co-founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition. Dr. Halper has been touring Canada for the last couple of weeks. He will be visiting Winnipeg Sunday, February 8th and Monday, February 9th, and locations further west in the days to follow. For more information about Jeff Halper and about the tour, visit www.icahd.org. Last month, outgoing Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird and Transport Minister Lisa Raitt signed a strategic partnership memorandum of understanding aimed at enhanced cooperation between Canada and Israel. These include a quote-unquote coordinated public diplomacy initiative to oppose boycotts of Israel, to oppose those who call into question the Jewish state's right to exist, and to work to counter the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. So what is the Harper government hoping to gain through its strategic partnerships with the Israeli state? To discuss this, we are joined once again by Eve Engler. Eve Engler is an Ottawa and Montreal-based activist and blogger and the author of 8 books, including Canada and Israel Building Apartheid, The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy, and his latest, The New Communist Manifesto, Workers of the World, It Really Is Time to Unite. Thank you for joining us, Eve Engler.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly is the state of the BDS campaign in Canada? Is it making major strides in your view?
It's definitely making strides. I think in North America in general, it's significantly behind where it is in Europe and obviously other places in the world. But in recent months, there's been a couple of victories here. The students at Concordia University, for instance, voted in referendum to support BDS movement. There's a longstanding picket of a Israeli shoe store company in Montreal that the finally forced the store actually to shut down. So there's obviously lots of number of unions that have passed resolutions. It's slower moving than I would like to see, but there is definitely a growing level of support for Palestinian human rights and that's being expressed in different resolutions and specific campaigns targeting Israeli companies complicit with different crimes of the Israeli state.
Is there something going on behind the scenes? Is there an economic incentive here, as if these partnerships are a kind of Trojan horse, or is it merely just the ideology of the government expressing itself?
Yeah, I don't think there's significant economic. I think that you could, it's possible that the current agreement on BDS is really seen as a sort of way to, in the lead up to the upcoming election, to win favor with in a couple of ridings where there's a significant number of Jewish voters. I think that's certainly a possibility. At one level, the passing or signing an agreement with Israel that says they will we'll combat the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign is completely outrageous. And the idea that the Canadian government would be trying to target social movements and international accords is quite frankly bizarre. But at the other level, it's sort of kind of irrelevant. It's just the Conservative government further affirming that they support all crimes of the Israeli government. They support Israel's right to dispossess Palestinians, I guess, forever. So it's not. It's just a ramping up of something that they've been doing for a number of years here. So I don't think it's going to have any impact or have very little impact on most Palestinian solidarity work. I think it probably does. It is somewhat it will sort of contribute to a sense of disenfranchisement within some of the Muslim community in Canada, that and make them more wary to take up the Palestinian cause. And I think that's been one of the Conservative government's intentions with a lot of this policy. For instance, their role in labeling Irfan, a charity, a Toronto charity, a Muslim charity based in Toronto, as a terrorist organization. What the point there is, in large part, is to sort of scare the Muslim community against taking up the Palestinian cause. So the recent accord with Israel maybe should be seen partly in light of the upsurge of fear of jihadism or what that the Harper government is really sort of going on about. But yeah, I don't think from the standpoint of the bulk of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, which tends to be sort of based around universities and left wing organizations in Canada, I don't think this has much impact.
But of course, we do have there's the recent anti-terrorism bill that was presented. Do you see this the partnership agreement with its views on BDS as somehow feeding that national security agenda?
Yeah. I think it can. I think that there's been a couple of documented examples where CSIS agents have been going to the houses of prominent pro-Palestinian activists and have been interviewing the friends of prominent pro-Palestinian activists. So this would sort of continue down that path or embolden CSIS agents or RCMP agents to surveil pro-Palestinian activists. And I think for sure there is it would contribute to that, but I don't, like I said, again, this is just this is example number 20 or more of the Harper government directly trying to pass resolution at the House of Commons condemning Israeli Apartheid Week or their whole campaign around the new anti-Semitism. This is just a further example of a long-standing campaign that I'm not sure will have all that much impact in and of itself, but taken as a whole, it clearly is creating a very hostile climate for those who want to stand up for Palestinian human rights.
I'm just wondering if we are likely to see anything here that could really bite down, that would really have teeth, that could to seriously, especially in combination with the anti-terrorism legislation, if this a real chill that we should be worried about, or is this just like a lot of hot air that we can dismiss?
Well, I don't think we should dismiss it. I think it is a chill. This is all of these pieces that when Stephen Harper goes on the radio and talks about the new anti-Semitism that's in some ways worse than the previous, and referring to the Nazi Holocaust. When he does that the point of that is to put chill into those who want to stand up for Palestinian rights and those who want to criticize Israeli policies. That is clearly the point. Same thing with the Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism. Same thing with you know, CSIS agents going to people's houses. Same thing with the government, you know, denouncing, putting out press releases denouncing the Canadian boat to Gaza. And obviously the new legislation around combating terrorism or is you know, they're setting up the climate, whether they are able to pull it off legally, but they're setting a climate where, you know, standing up for, you know, saying that that, you know, Israel's has much more blood on its hand than Hamas does, which is, you know, considered a listed terrorist organization in this country, which is a, you know, a basic fact. To say that is you know, considered you know, backing terrorist organization. To hold a Hezbollah flag at a demonstration is you know, providing support for a terrorist organization, and that, and therefore you get, you know thrown in jail for that. The that's clearly where the conservative government is going. Already, what they have on the list on the books in terms of legislation that you know, banning forms of support for most Palestinian political factions, and so the group I mentioned, IRFAN, which is the getting what the acronym stands for, International for Afflicted and Needy, something like that. The reason they got their charitable status cut off was because they were providing a support to the health ministry in Gaza, providing they sent dialysis machine to the health ministry in Gaza, and they also were providing support to orphans in Gaza. The money for the orphans went through the post office, as is common in many places. The post office is run by the government in Gaza. The government in Gaza is Hamas. The dialysis machine went to a hospital in Gaza. Again, Hamas, as the elected authority in Gaza, was running the health ministry. So they were seen as, they lost their charitable status because they were seen as supporting Hamas. And then when they tried to challenge the campaign of them losing their charitable status, the Harper government listed them as a terrorist organization. So this is the first, as I understand, the first Canadian-based organization that's been listed as a terrorist organization. It's completely ludicrous. Their lawyer that's challenging this can't even, he can't be paid because it's unclear if that would be taking material support from a terrorist organization, and then he would then be in defiance of the law. So it's all, legally speaking, it's all quite a murky territory, but the you know, the impact is certainly to send a chill, particularly again within the Muslim community, of those who are, you know, standing up for Palestinian human rights, but, you know, broadly again among the population in general. It's a way of extreme support for the expansionist Israeli state.
Well, chilling indeed. I think we have to leave it there. But Eve Engler, I want to thank you very much for once again sharing your thoughts with us on this interesting political dynamic.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Eve Engler, Montreal and Ottawa-based activist and author. Eve Engler's website is eveengler.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.